Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Hello, True Crime fans, and welcome back to the True Crime Never Sleeps podcast. I'm your host, as always, Larry Lease. And of course, before we get into today's Cold Case Friday episode, don't forget to subscribe to the channel, hit the bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And with that, let's dive into today's story. Rachel Truliso had just gotten the news that her stepson was going to be staying in her house on Christmas morning. At the time, Rachel was 17 and still in high school. She was married to her husband, Tommy, who was 22. And already had a child. To say the least, the situation was rather strange, even for the 70s. Anyhow, upon hearing the news, Rachel decided to go to the mall to get her stepson some additional gifts. She wanted to make a day out of it. So she asked her sister Deborah if she wanted to tag along. At the time, Deborah was staying at Tommy and Rachel's house, and the night before, the three of them stayed up until 4 a.m. playing cards. Deborah, too tired, declined the offer. This led Rachel to ask one of her longtime school friends, Renee, if she wanted to come to the mall with her. Renee lived quite close to Rachel. However, on this day, she was over at her grandmother's house. Things get slightly confusing here, but I'll explain it as simply as possible. Across the street from Renee's grandmother lived a woman named Renee, a mother of three children, 16-year-old Terry, 11-year-old Jeanette, and 9-year-old Julie. Terry was Renee's boyfriend, and together they had plans to go out for a Christmas party at 4 p.m. That day, Renee agreed to go to the mall with Rachel, as long as she'd be home by 4 p.m. While Renee and Terry were talking, Terry's younger sister Julie was eavesdropping on their conversation and overheard Rachel's invitation to the mall. Julie instantly wanted to tag along and immediately phoned her mother, who was at work. Renee, Julie's mother, recalled parts of the phone call. Julie had asked to go to the South Cemetery Mall. Renee initially replied, "No, you don't have any money, you just stay home." However, after some persuasion, Renee gave in and allowed her daughter to go, as long as she returned by 6 p.m. Since Renee needed to return home for the Christmas party at 4, they agreed to take Julie along with them. At noon, Rachel picked up the girls in her husband's car. The three made it to the South Cemetery Mall and parked their car in the east lot of the mall. It was very busy at the time, as it was the Christmas holidays and many people, including the girls, were out doing last-minute shopping. Some witnesses recall seeing the girls enter the mall. Once the girls entered the mall, their fate became shrouded in mystery. It was the 70s, a time before security cameras could track every step in a busy mall, especially during the Christmas holidays. The trio easily blended into the holiday crowds. What happened next remains a mystery to this day. Renee did not show up at the Christmas party, and none of the girls returned home. Rachel's mother was the first to realize they were missing, so she took Rachel's younger brother, Rusty, to the mall to search for her. By this time, there were many cars left in the parking lot as it was getting closer to closing time. Desperately, Rachel's mother headed inside the mall. After tirelessly searching one by one, each store began to close, and the girls were nowhere to be found. Hey everyone, welcome back. Hopefully you had a good Christmas. But today, I want to seriously talk about online security, an issue that affects every single one of us. Do you ever feel like there's someone looking over your shoulder every time you're browsing, streaming, or just checking your email? It's more common than you think. And that's exactly why I'm excited to tell you about NordVPN. With NordVPN, you can say goodbye to those sketchy pop-ups and shady trackers following your every move. Instead, imagine having a digital fortress around your data. Banking transactions, passwords, and even private chats remain, well, private. NordVPN uses the next-level encryption, which basically means your data is locked away behind a secure wall. So if nosy neighbors, big tech companies, or even your internet service provider tries to peek, they'll hit a dead end. And here's the really cool part. With one click, you can instantly change your virtual location. Travel virtually to another country, skip it, those annoying geo restrictions, and stream that exclusive show from Europe, Asia, or anywhere else. In other words, if you've been itching to watch a series that's not available in your region, NordVPN just opened the door for you. Now let's talk about the deal. It's a big one. Right now, you can grab 72% off your NordVPN subscription. Yes, 72% off. As if that wasn't sweet enough, they're also throwing in an additional 3 free months. That means you're scoring total online protection for a fraction of the normal cost, with 3 extra months totally on the house. This is the kind of offer that doesn't come around often. Setting up NordVPN is ridiculously easy. Just download the app on your phone, laptop, even your TV. Log in and boom, your internet traffic is automatically encrypted. No more complicated settings to fiddle with. Just press connect, pick a server, and you're good to go. It's that simple. Protect your data, hide your IP, and keep hackers at bay, all while enjoying lightning-fast speeds for streaming, gaming, or just scrolling through social media. So why wait? Click the link and head over to NordVPN right now to snag that sweet 72% off deal plus those 3 free months. Your future self will thank you when you realize just how easy and stress-free secure browsing can be. And that's all for today. Stay safe online with NordVPN. And now on to the rest of today's episode. Panic immediately set in for Rachel's mother. She asked the manager to make an announcement to see if the girls were still there, but nothing happened. Meanwhile, Rusty wasn't so concerned about Rachel's whereabouts at the time. He knew his sister could be rebellious. Nevertheless, Rachel's mother called the police and reported her daughter and her friends missing. The police pulled up to Rachel's car, which was still sitting abandoned in the mall's parking lot. At first glance, it looked like any other car. There were no signs of a struggle inside the car, no shattered glass, no forced entry, no bloodstains. Doors were locked and the keys were missing. Inside, everything was strangely neat. Shopping bags from the mall sat on the back seat untouched. To everyone passing by, it looked as though the girls had simply returned from shopping and then wandered off. The scene was calm, too calm. Something was clearly off. However, it was no surprise that the officers initially thought, there's nothing here, just another group of teenagers running off. Something to note that in the 70s, more and more young women were running away from home. The feminist movement was challenging traditional family roles, and many families were in financial turmoil due to rising inflation and unemployment. For many young women across America, home didn't feel like home, so they'd run away, sometimes never returning. Sadly, with the overwhelming numbers of missing person cases, police often assumed these girls had run away. This is likely why the police initially believed the girls were runaways. Nevertheless, Rachel's husband, Tommy, the owner of the vehicle, went through his car and noticed two things missing. $50 worth of savings bonds, which he had purchased with his first wife, and a copy of his parents' will. Both of Tommy's parents had recently passed away. This didn't add up, especially with 9-year-old Julie in the mix. It felt like something was terribly wrong. Why would Rachel first invite her sister, Deborah, to tag along? Rachel never mentioned anything about running away when planning the trip to the mall. The whole situation seemed strange. If you truly want to run away, you won't look back. You'd leave as quickly as possible. Yet these girls hadn't been seen taking their time shopping in a local store that evening. That night, the fathers of the three girls stood watch over the car at the mall. They remained there through the night, hoping whoever was involved might return to the scene. As morning came, police still had firm to their belief that the girls had simply run away, until Christmas Eve when Tommy and Deborah brought the police a strange letter they had received. The letter was already raising red flags. The outside of the envelope was written in pencil, but the letter inside was written in pen. Oddly, the envelope was much larger than the letter it contained, suggesting it may have come from somewhere else. The letter was signed by Rachel, but it was unusual. She always referred to her husband as Tommy, but in the letter he was addressed formally as Thomas A. The message read, quote, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week." cars in Sears' upper lot. Love, Rachel. None of it made sense. Why would Rachel leave town so suddenly, especially on Christmas Eve, with her stepson coming to stay with her? And why would she take Renee and Julie away from their families on Christmas Day? When closely inspecting the letter, police noticed the postmark was strangely blurred, making it difficult to determine where it had come from. Rachel's parents and brothers were convinced she hadn't written the letter. Perhaps the most unsettling part of it all was the fact that nothing had been delivered to their mailbox that day. No junk mail, no Christmas cards. It was almost as if the letter had been placed there by hand, rather than delivered by a postman. Christmas and New Year's, a time usually filled with joy and laughter, now felt empty. How could the family celebrate when someone they loved was missing? Roughly 1 week had passed when suddenly, at the turn of the year, a new lead emerged. A man who knew Rachel's father called, claiming to have seen all three girls at the mall on December 23rd. He stated that he had briefly spoken to Rachel in the record department of a store and that someone else was with the girls. Was this person a man, a woman? No one knows. The newspaper article reporting this lead provided no further details, leaving the identity of the individual up to speculation. As the investigation went on, the police kept most of the information closely guarded. This was typical for the time. Even as the case grew cold, many new developments were kept from the public. On January 3rd, a detective voiced his frustration, saying, "I wish we just had one clue to get us off that parking lot." Every path they tried seemed to lead nowhere. There was no sign the girls had been harmed, but equally, no proof they were safe. The runaway theory began to fade further as an officer admitted, "No one seems to really believe they went to Houston." Though this was already painfully clear, the police initially urged the families not to worry, at least not until the leads dried up. By this point, the leads were drying up fast. In their desperation, the families turned to other options. Renee's mother sought out a psychic named J. Joseph, a man some believed had true psychic abilities. To her shock, Joseph revealed details about Renee that were not publicly known, like the fact that she had been wearing red and white tennis shoes on that day she went missing. He also raised doubts about the letter Rachel had supposedly written, suggesting that girls were being held in a rural area, possibly near Grapevine, or as far as Oklahoma. Before their session ended, Joseph left the families with a chilling message. "If you don't hear from me again, it means all three girls are dead." The families never saw or heard from J. Joseph ever again. Then, on January 8th, the Wilson family received a phone call that sparked a bit of hope. A friend of Renee's father was contacted by a girl claiming to be a friend of Renee. The caller said that all three missing girls, Rachel, Renee, and Julie, would return that night on a Greyhound bus, arriving from Houston at exactly 7:25 p.m. The families rushed to the bus station, desperate for this to be the moment they had been praying for. They waited anxiously, scanning each face as passengers came off the bus, but as the minutes passed and the station emptied, the harsh truth began to sink in. The girls weren't on that bus. Rachel's mother, who had been at the station earlier, felt a disturbing unease throughout the entire ordeal. She later confessed that she had a strong feeling someone had been lurking in the shadows, silently watching and laughing. It was a chilling thought that wouldn't leave her mind. She could have never anticipated what came next. When Renee's parents returned from the station, they stepped into chaos. Their house had been ransacked. Doors were open, belongings were scattered everywhere. At first, it seemed like a burglary, but the timing... It was too strange, too precise.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Taxes was waiting around for your taxes to be done, which led to worrying about not getting any money back. Now Taxes is matching with a TurboTax expert who can do your taxes in a day to get you up to $4,000 fast with a refund advance loan. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Expert filing only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Refund advance has $0 loan fees and 0% APR. Refund advance loans may be issued by First Century Bank, N.A. or Web Bank. Terms apply, subject to approval.
Something far more unsettling was happening. This unsettling timing raised immediate suspicions. Renee's mother couldn't shake her doubts about the phone call. When she reached out to Renee's circle of friends, none of them recognized the voice of the caller. As time passed, the strange phone call proved to be only the beginning of a nightmare. The family soon found themselves bombarded by a relentless wave of hoax calls. They were left helpless, unable to stop the barrage of malicious calls that only deepened their pain and confusion. Then on February 7th, Renee, Julie's mother, answered her phone only to be met with silence. She repeated, "Hello?" several times, ready to hang up, and suddenly she heard a faint voice. It was a little girl, barely audible, whispering, "Mama?" "Is this Julie Mosley?" Renee asked. The little girl softly replied, "Yes." Desperate, Renee begged to know where she was, but the child didn't have an answer. Before she could ask more, the call was abruptly cut off. Renee was shaken by the phone call. Something about the voice sounded off, almost as if the child was intoxicated. Still, she clung to hope. "I know there's a possibility someone is putting me on, but at least I know she's alive, and that helps. But where is she?" Rachel's mother held on to every lead she could find, desperate for answers. One of those leads came from an elderly woman who claimed she might have seen the girls being abducted while out shopping on December 23rd. The woman reported seeing something very alarming, a yellow truck with flashing lights on top. Inside, there were two girls and a man appearing to be trying to force another girl into the vehicle. The sighting prompted the girls' families to take matters into their own hands by hiring a private investigator named John Swain. John ran a company called Special Services, but there was definitely something unusual about him. He was bold, unafraid to stir the pot, and knew how to grab attention. Some even said he had a flair for the dramatic. When John first took on the case, he wasted no time. He called a press conference, publicly criticizing the Fort Worth Police Department for the handling of the investigation. John claimed there was a license plate number and a description of the vehicle that could have been involved in the girl's disappearance, yet the police hadn't acted on it. He also accused the police of destroying tape recordings that might have been evidence. In response, the police fired back. "He wants everything we've got. I don't see where we're obligated to turn over everything. We don't open our files to anybody. It's against all sort of rules and laws, and that's our policy." In April of that year, John made another bold claim. He said he had received information from an unnamed source suggesting that girls had been killed and that their bodies were hidden under a bridge near Port Lavaca, Texas. With this information, John orchestrated a large-scale search, rallying hundreds of volunteers to comb through the area. But like so many other leads, this one ended in disappointment. Nothing was found. This was the pattern with John's investigation. He would latch onto a lead, follow it aggressively, and if successful, pivot to the next theory. He seemed to have a very narrow focus and struggled to see the bigger picture. Despite this, he continued working on the case tirelessly. In 1979, John's investigation came to an abrupt end when he was found dead. His death was officially ruled a suicide. However, what followed raised even more questions. After his death, Renee's mother reached out to John's family, hoping to recover photos and evidence she had lent him for his investigation. To her surprise, she discovered that all of John's files had been burned after his death. It turned out that John had left instructions for all his files to be destroyed upon his passing. This meant that every scrap of evidence and potential lead he had gathered over 3 years had gone up in flames. Speculation surrounded John's death, with many believing he had uncovered something dangerous and had taken his own life to protect whatever secrets he had found. Others wondered if he had been silenced by someone who wanted the investigation buried. Whatever the truth, the consequences of John's death was devastating for the case. 3 years of evidence, leads, and potential breakthroughs were lost forever, leaving a gaping hole in the investigation. By 1994, almost 20 years had passed since the trio's disappearance. The families of the missing girls were still haunted by the pain of unanswered questions. In a 94 interview, Rachel's siblings, Rusty and Deborah, expressed their frustration with the police department. Deborah said, "We have a lot of anger and resentment. They didn't run away, they vanished. We don't care about prosecution, we just want answers and some closure." For Rusty, the disappearance of his sister had left a permanent wound that never healed. He had been struggling with it his entire life. His dedication to the case led him to reach out to another private investigator named Dan James in 96. Someone who had already been looking into the case independently. Dan James was no stranger to the Fort Worth Trio case. He had spent thousands of dollars and countless hours investigating it. At one point, he even offered a $5,000 reward from his own money for information. Despite receiving anonymous threats warning him to stop investigating, Dan persisted. And his persistence paid off in the year 2000 when several witnesses came forward claiming they had seen Rachel at the Fort Worth Mall after the date of her disappearance. This gave her family hope that she might still be alive. Dan developed a theory based on his findings. He believed that Renee was no longer alive and that something dreadfully wrong, like likely fatal, had happened to Julianne Mosley. However, he held on to the possibility that Rachel might still be alive. With a focus on Rachel, Dan began digging deeper into her background. What he uncovered was surprising. Dan discovered that Rachel's husband, Tommy, had been previously engaged to Deborah, Rachel's sister, possibly just weeks before marrying Rachel. Although it's unclear how serious Tommy's relationship with Deborah was, it became apparent that Tommy moved on quickly. Tommy ended his first marriage in April 1974, and by June of that same year, he was already married to Rachel. This timeline meant that whatever relationship he had with Deborah must have taken place sometime in between, likely in May. The relationship between Tommy and Deborah became a central point of suspicion. Rumors began to surface about an argument between Rachel, Tommy, and Deborah on the night before Rachel disappeared. Rusty started questioning what might have really happened, but Deborah strongly denied that any argument had taken place. The rumors didn't stop there. Whispers of an affair between Tommy and Deborah began to spread, further fueling distrust. Although Deborah denied any romantic involvement with Tommy, these accusations created a rift between her and Rusty. If we go back to the letter Rachel supposedly wrote, it becomes even harder to believe she wrote and mailed it. In the 70s, the postal system wasn't as efficient as it is today. The letter was postmarked just 2 days after the girls disappeared, raising doubts about how it could have been written, mailed, and delivered so quickly. The police sent the letter to the FBI 3 times for analysis. Each time, the FBI requested more handwriting samples from Rachel. Her family sent stacks of her writing. Despite this, the results were inconclusive every time. This uncertainty made Deborah an even bigger target for suspicion. Many people believed that someone close to Rachel must have forged the letter. Some even speculated that Deborah herself had written it. Even the families of the other girls shared these suspicions. One family member said, quote, "I've got it in my head that him and Deborah were involved, but until the police find someone who stands up and tells me face to face, I did it, then I'm going to have that on my mind." Quite a few parents died with that thought. With suspicions mounting, Rachel's family decided to take action. Rusty and the family sent a letter to Deborah, pleading with her to cooperate with the investigation. The letter read, "Dear Deborah, you indicated you had nothing to hide. We beg and plead with you to fully cooperate with the Fort Worth Police Department and the FBI. Please complete the polygraph test and answer all questions. Deborah, please keep in mind that you also have a sister missing." As the investigation continued, suspicion extended beyond Deborah to their father. Reports surfaced that both Rachel and Deborah were terrified of their father because of his violent temper. While Rusty had a completely different experience being the son their father always wanted, the girls bore the brunt of his abuse. Rusty would later claim he was very abusive to the girls. Private investigator Dan James also uncovered disturbing details about their father. He found evidence that suggested the father had relationships with multiple young women, and that Rachel and Deborah may have been victims of his abuse. Dan speculated that Rachel might have been pregnant at the time of her disappearance, which could have played a role in the case. He claimed to have found medical records suggesting a pregnancy, though these records were never publicly released. Despite these revelations, the police kept many details hidden from the public. The level of secrecy was unusual, especially for a case that remained unsolved for over 50 years. However, law enforcement did not dismiss Dan's theory outright. In 2001, the case was reassigned to a new detective who decided to take a fresh approach. In March of that year, the detective held a press conference, announcing he had reached out to 70 witnesses and identified 20 new ones. Among these new witnesses was Bill Hutchins, a security guard who had been working at the Fort Worth Mall on the day the girls disappeared. Bill recounted seeing the girls in a truck driven by another young security guard. He remembered the girls laughing and appearing at ease, which gave him no reason to suspect anything was wrong at the time. Nearly 3 decades had passed before investigators finally reached out to Bill. When they located and questioned the young security guard he had identified, the man denied ever seeing the girls or being involved in their disappearance. By then, over 30 years had passed, making it nearly impossible to verify the truth. As the years passed, theories continued to swirl around the disappearance of Rachel, Renee, and Julie. There was no solid evidence to prove any single theory. Certain details stood out. The strange letter, for instance, continued to haunt the investigation. Many believed it was a fabrication meant to mislead the families and authorities. But if so, who wrote it and why? Rusty and the family's suspicions of Deborah lingered. Some believed she knew more than she was letting on. Though no concrete evidence ever suggested or ever surfaced to implicate her. Dan James, the private investigator, firmly believed Rachel was still alive. He suspected something dreadful had happened to Renee and Julie, but maintained hopes that Rachel could still be found. His investigation, however, was limited by time, resources, and a lack of cooperation from law enforcement. It has now been over 50 years since Rachel, Renee, and Julie vanished without a trace. The case remains unsolved, leaving their families to grapple with the pain of unanswered questions and the weight of an enduring mystery. In the decades following the disappearance, many family members passed away without ever knowing what happened to their loved ones. Rachel's brother Rusty and the private investigator Dan James were among those who dedicated their lives to seeking the truth but never found the closure they desperately needed. The Fort Worth Trio case stands as a chilling reminder of how quickly lives can be turned upside down, how fragile the truth can be, and how, even in the face of overwhelming mystery, families will hold on to hope for as long as they can. To this day, no one truly knows what happened to Rachel, Renee, and Julie on that fateful day in 1974. So, with that, let me know your theories of what happened in the comments section below. Give us a thumbs up if you like your video. Hit that subscribe button down below. Hit the bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And of course, if you want to support the channel, buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you in the next episode.
If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks. Plus, you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.